From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in West Virginia when a man walked into a stranger's house. The man had been invited to this particular home, but to say he was surprised by what he saw is an understatement. The man had arrived to shadow a private investigator named Frank Streets. Frank Streets was not only a PI, but a hunter. And when the man entered Streets' home, he walked into a room full of taxidermied animals. Deer, a fox, a bobcat, fish affixed to plaques on the walls. There were pelts and antlers, trophies, and guns. A full-on display of the apparent masculinity of the private investigator, Frank Streets. The man who was scheduled to meet with him was a writer searching for a story. As Stephen J. West gazed around the den, he thought, quote, "I could cut Frank Streets down here and conclude that his identity as an outdoorsman was reductive, that he wanted me to admire his manliness, but I could see through his hunting prowess to the expression of fragility it represented. Lo, the phallus goes boom, and the bodies of animals are rendered proof of virility. But I am no better. What kind of man am I?" End quote. And that's really the central question of West's debut memoir. In the years of his book coming to be, West was navigating that question from a number of different angles, as an artist, as a husband, as a new father. Through research, self-discovery, and his experience shadowing Frank Streets, West assesses what it means to be a man and a writer, and the intersection of those two identities. The end product is his book called Soft Boiled, An Investigation of Masculinity and the Writer's Life. West will give a talk at Writers and Books this week, but first he joins us to discuss the process and what he learned here on Connections. Stephen, welcome. Thank you for making time to be here.
Thanks for inviting me.
When's the earliest age you knew you wanted to be an author?
Well, I think it would have to be in my teenage years. I was reading a lot of fiction and novels at that time, and I grew up in Livonia, which is about 30 minutes south of here, and to be honest, there wasn't a ton that I felt like I could connect to in terms of like that interest in writing. So the novels that I would pick up from school or in the library or the Scholastic book sale, I would just try to mimic those, but it never really fit. It never really felt right in terms of like the form. Like I could tell early on I wasn't a very good fiction writer. But that was probably it. But I still kind of harbored those dreams and wrote bad poetry all throughout my teen years.
Well, that seems rather finite. I could tell I wasn't a good writer in my teenage years. That doesn't mean, therefore, you will always not be the writer that you want to be, right?
Yeah, that's right, I guess. But yeah, I've suspected, though, that, you know, poetry wasn't my thing pretty early on.
But it's interesting that you're growing up in Livingston County, and even early in your life, you have some identity issues in that you had two parents who were teachers. So unlike a lot of the kids you were growing up with, you didn't grow up on a farm. You didn't have farming in the family. So on the one hand, you know, you wrestled with that feeling of, am I going to be, I'm from Livingston County. Will the world see me as a certain thing, which might be a stereotype of someone from rural America? On the other hand, will my classmates and people here think of me as sort of posh and not authentic because I'm not growing up in a farm? So you had these identity issues even early on, didn't you?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, I often joke that I grew up on one of the only cul-de-sacs in Livonia, and it was a cul-de-sac that never really finished getting developed. I had two houses on it the whole time. So, before I was able to actually leave that area and kind of explore places that my parents would take me to or travel with our family, you know, I didn't quite understand, like, you know, most of the people that I grew up with were, you know, connected to the farms or the rural landscape. A lot of people, of course, down there traveled to Rochester for work. But my parents, like you mentioned, were educators. So they always had a great value for travel and kind of the world of ideas that was out there that I didn't really know how to access yet, especially as a young person. But I could tell it wasn't necessarily immediately around me. So
did you feel cast out or not accepted because of your family and your background?
Oh, not at all. No.
That's all in your head.
Oh, for sure.
See?
Yeah, yeah. It's on brand for, you know.
It's on brand for you.
Yeah.
No, the book really is about wrestling in so many ways with identity. And even, you know, as you get through high school and you start thinking about education, maybe you wanted to go to art school in New York City, but you end up going to Geneseo. Why?
Well, I had accepted to go to Pratt Institute for Art, and I was really excited about it, but I also was, you know, nervous about moving to New York City. I think I was probably less willing at that time to acknowledge how important it is for me to be, you know, in a smaller community, having people that I know around me and close. I had these aspirations of like going and taking over New York, but it just wasn't part of my nature. And I had to kind of, you know, had to kind of deal with that kind of sense of failure early on, because I withdrew from there and actually attended RIT first for art for a year and a half before dropping out of school entirely, thinking, I don't even know what I'm going to do. But I moved back home, and my dad was actually a professor at Geneseo at the time. And he's like, well, why don't you just take a couple classes at Geneseo? And so I did, and I met some incredible faculty there. And that's when I kind of transitioned into English, but never really left that interest in art behind.
And eventually you go to graduate school where?
University of Iowa.
Yeah. That's where you meet. That's where you met your wife there.
Yep, Carlene. Yep.
But then, of all places, you end up in West Virginia. And I can relate to this, having lived in West Virginia for a little while. Mm-hmm. But tell the listeners a little bit about that path there and what was going on in your life.
Okay, for sure. So when I met Carlene in Iowa, she was a couple years ahead of me. She was studying political science. So by the time we'd moved through graduate school, she was on the job market before I was really finished with my coursework. And she was, you know, she's super smart, highly successful, really motivated, obviously was going to get hired any place she applied to. So she applied to several places. And, you know, being from Western New York, I knew that Morgantown, where she applied and eventually got the first job, was close, like 6-hour drive, not bad. And I had actually spent some time before graduate school. I walked the Appalachian Trail from Georgia to Maine, and I love the mountains there, right? And so I was like, well, this is great. I love the landscape. It's close to the Eastern Seaboard and cities and family. And I was also thinking we could make this kind of little rural place our own. We could kind of forge our identity here. So it was a place that we both agreed was a good opportunity potentially. So she took the job because, of course, she got it. And we moved there, super optimistic about moving to West Virginia at that time.
Morgantown, though. Not that there's anything wrong with Morgantown, but having lived, I worked in Huntington, Charleston, I lived in Hurricane, okay. Right between the two. Morgantown, for us in the center part of the state, always felt like, well, that's really just Pittsburgh. Even though, I mean, what is it, an hour from Pittsburgh? Is it more?
Just over an hour. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's on the border, but it's still West Virginia, very much so. And I'm mostly kidding about this. But for you, was it... Well, describe the experience of being in West Virginia then.
Yeah, for sure. So we actually wanted to live in Pittsburgh, but that drive from Pittsburgh south to Morgantown is a little dicey sometimes. So, you know what? We had a wonderful lifestyle, to be honest, when we first moved there. We intentionally bought a place right in the South Park neighborhood within walking distance of downtown and the university. So, you know, we really valued that walking culture, that kind of walking lifestyle that we had when we were in Iowa City as well. And it offered us that. And, you know, in that sense, it was really good. And the people we met there in our neighborhood, we still have friends that we keep in touch with. So and by those measures, it was a good start for us.
Okay. But?
You know, our relationship to the place changed.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we first moved there, we were, again, optimistic about how we could kind of bend West Virginia to match our identities, even though we were quite obviously outsiders. But, you know, the longer we were there, we could kind of see that there were some cultural situations that we were uncomfortable in and couldn't really adapt to. Maybe that's a flaw
so
on our side.
There's a couple things that come up for me here. Yeah. First of all, what's an example of a situation that was not comfortable for you?
Well, the healthcare system was one. We had a couple things happen. Carlene had an experience with her vision where she had to have, I'm forgetting the name of the procedure now on the spot here, but her retina was detached. That's it. I just got it. And they had to do a retinopathy where they actually remove all the gel of her eye and do all this. And in West Virginia, they're at the Eye Institute, they're like, oh, yeah, we can do this. And we were very young and had never experienced any kind of health complications like this. We're like, okay, fine. It's a university hospital. This is good. And just the kind of cavalier nature that we experienced in terms of the treatment, and it didn't go well. She ended up with nerve damage in her eye and lost vision. And the kind of, I don't know, the fallout from that. I don't know. For example, we went to a lawyer to see if we could pursue any, you know, legal action, because the doctors never told us what actually happened during the procedure. And they looked at us and said, well, there's just some things you don't do in West Virginia. And this was a West Virginian. And so not that that was like, oh, that's it. But it was just an interesting perspective that even people who lived there had about the place itself.
Like healthcare, eh.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean,
yeah,
it was just surprising. Yeah.
And when you talk about moving to a new place, having an idea in your mind about what you might find, and then the reality, I'm struck by how culture forms and either resists change or changes with people. So for you and Carlene, you thought maybe, you know, we can move there and kind of bend it to what you expected or want it to be. And what you found is in some ways you kind of could, or you fit and found stuff that you like, but then you couldn't change enough to feel comfortable. And I wonder if you think place resists people who come in and try to bring change, or if that change is possible and culture moves with an influx of new people.
That's a complex question, Evan, yeah. And a good one, I think. I mean, I don't know if place resists change. I think that place influences the cultural identity of the people that live there. Mm-hmm. And as far as West Virginia goes, what I know about it, not just from living there, but doing my homework on it, this is a place that has been repeatedly, perpetually exploited by the coal industry.
Absolutely.
And yes. And it's hard to imagine that kind of social situation, that societal situation, those cultural factors not kind of seeping into the marrow of the people that live there. And I think that this is kind of how I've now narrativized some of what I experienced. The answer, there are some things you just don't do here. And not in like can you believe, like, I'm looking down on the place I live from this woman who was West Virginian, right? But just an acceptance of that, you know? And I don't know if that's place-based or not, but I do think histories do influence how people feel and think about themselves.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, and I just to kind of build on the point of an industry that exploits people, even though that industry is composed of, you know, sort of the working class who does the work of it, I think what Stephen's talking about, and certainly I would agree with, is it's the people in power that are exploiting a people. So sometimes we have this tendency in political debate or in social discourse to sort of we turn entire populations into a monolith. Well, West Virginia is this, or rural America is that. Livingston County is this. Florida is that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real risk to that, because that it strips away, I think, the reality of what it is like to live there, of what those powerful forces are doing and why they're doing it.
For sure. And I think maybe you could even sense some of my resistance or hesitance to kind of speak on behalf of West Virginia.
Sure, or absolutely.
As an outsider that simply lived there for 6 years.
I sense for sure a desire not to just malign an entire state that mm-hmm. is often a target.
For sure. And far more complex than any of our kind of simple stereotypical definitions of that place seem to, you know, come up with. So a target, too. It's a great way to define it.
Yeah. So talking to Stephen J. West, whose book is called Soft Boiled, and where we are now in his sort of process of telling his own story is meeting a man named Frank Streets, who I mentioned off the top here. But why don't you introduce Frank Streets to the listeners here?
Sure. Yeah, I loved the way you introduced that. That's actually one of the opening scenes in this this book, where I encountered him for the first time. And, you know, he is every bit of the kind of, you know, larger than life, you know, hyper masculine West Virginian that you can imagine. I mean, it will seem, if you read this opening scene, some of what Evan shared, that I'm being, that I'm exaggerating.
Caricaturing or cartoonish?
Yeah. And I mean, I do take a little creative license with some of it, but not in terms of the scale of his hunting and trapping prowess, or how deep his investment in these kind of, you know, icons of masculinity go. Like, this is, and it's not just a show either. I know in this section that you read, it says I could cut him down easily here. I mean, that seems, that would be from my perspective on what I see, but he's actually very much identifies with those objects, those guns, those busts, these tales of hunting and trapping. Like, this is who he is, and it's authentic and to him, even though I can kind of see it as a kind of fabrication of a kind of identity, right? And so, I don't know if this is answering your question about, like, what I think about Frank Streets. I actually think the world of him. He's actually tried to get him to join us on the show today. And I can tell you more about my most recent interaction with him in a little bit, but he's just a very generous and hilarious and super smart person. He would fill probably 2 hours of your show with the stories he can tell, and they're always compelling too. So when I first met him as a weenie writer trying to find something to write about, I knew that this person was someone that I could attach myself to and find something through him. I thought when I first met him, I would maybe write a profile piece, something small. But the way he invited me into his life, again, generously, was really something.
Why did he?
Well, that's up for debate. I think he saw me as no threat, right? But I do also think that Frank has a kind of interest in attention, too, like most people. And as a writer, he didn't know anything about my background or what I was working on, but saying, hey, I'm writing a book. I'm interested in private investigators, what they do. Can I shadow you? I mean, I think in some cases, or in some way, that attention was valuable to him, was meaningful. So he saw me as a way to, kind of garner some of that. So.
And he was right to assess you as no threat anyway.
Thanks. You saw that when I walked in, probably.
Right? People would say the same about me, Steve. But also core here, when we think about Frank, is your assessment. You're not denigrating him by saying that he is the picture of what a stereotype of masculinity would be. The guns, the hunting trophies, etc. You're not saying that in a sneering way. You're not laughing at him. You're just observing that in our culture, over decades, this has been the presented picture of it. You're also saying that for him, it's not inauthentic per se. That is what he would probably say is a man's world, and mm-hmm. that is something he is very comfortable in. Mm-hmm. So then I'm wondering if you've now decided masculinity means a lot of different things and can, or do you look at that and say, I love the guy, he's generous, he was wonderful to me, but I think that that's a bit of a busted view of what masculinity should be.
I don't know if I would say it's a busted view. Because so many people ascribe to it. So it's obviously working still, but do I think it could have some problems? For sure. I think it is what you said initially there. Like, it's far more complex. I mean, I think having some kind of like monolithic perception of what masculinity, capital M, means is dated. It's far more contemporary and probably useful to think about it in terms of a spectrum of masculinities, right? I know that that's how scholarship views it.
Listeners, maybe... wondering if you got to tail him on any of these cases, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But of course, my interest was, did you like talk politics with the guy? I want to know about all the other stuff here.
Yeah, not too much. I listened very closely, though. And just based on how he talked about the different cases he was working on, the cases that I followed him and shadowed him while he was working on, the way he would talk to his co-PIs that he would, take out into the field with him, I could glean enough of, certain political perspectives, certain kind of takes. And I don't know. I didn't think, I tried to keep myself present when I was with him, but not necessarily trying to influence or direct the way he would act in any situation. Because I thought that, I was kind of trying to adopt a more journalistic mode when I was with him, just to observe and in some ways act like a private eye. Just gather facts, information, what I see, how he acts, take all the notes I possibly can, and then later try to assemble it into some kind of story. When I was with him, I avoided some of that. I didn't want to like press him into opinions or takes because that felt like I would have an agenda. And I'm honest when I'm saying when I wrote along with him, I didn't know what I was writing about. I was just there to see what presented itself.
Right. You weren't going, well, here's the picture of masculinity. I've got it all figured out now. I know there was still a lot for you to sort of learn and gather and see. But I'm thinking about traditional ideas of masculinity, and I'm reminded of a conversation I had this summer about gun ownership in this country. And one of the hard parts about having conversations about guns, and I don't know why it took this long in my life for someone to distill it this well, but here's how it was distilled to me. First of all, the problem is there are only two kinds of people when it comes to guns. People who feel safer when they have a gun, and people who feel less safe or not safe at all when guns are around. That's it. From there, you can work out everything else, how people feel about safe storage, teaching kids about gun ownership, sporting rifles, everything. That is fundamentally true, and I never thought about it that way. Hmm. Now, the person who's making this point then said, men tend to be the ones who feel safer with guns, which is, according to surveys and rates of purchase, et cetera, true. It's a generalization. It's not always true, but it is. So I wonder if, did you ever find yourself thinking, like, why is this guy, Frank Streets, he is so comfortable with a gun, he feels well-trained, he's not worried about what could happen with it, he feels like he could use it to defend himself if necessary, he uses it for sport. Did you ever think, like, why are he and I so different?
I never sat and really reflected on that particular question in that way. I guess so much of the assumption of my difference from Frank had to do with, you know, going back to your point about place, right? I was the kind of Northeasterner. He would look at me and see a kind of effete, you know, intellectual. And I would look at him and see this kind of rural mountain man. And so much of that immediately to me just felt like, that kind of explains a lot of our relationships to something like gun ownership. I don't know. I lived, like you mentioned earlier, grew up in Livingston County where tons of people own guns too. I mean, to be honest, Livingston County is not that different from some parts of West Virginia.
That's absolutely true. When we talk about the Northeast in this country, or we talk about red states, blue states, that isn't a very helpful construct anymore, because mm-hmm. what we really have are more cosmopolitan areas, and then we have rural America. And rural America in New York, Western New York, is not all that dissimilar. It's quite similar in many ways to rural America in the South, in West Virginia, in the Midwest. I mean, there are a lot of commonalities there, absolutely.
Yes, exactly. And so I think that was a more interesting kind of question to me about, not that I grew up or even identify as someone who's from an urban community necessarily, but far more cosmopolitan, especially with how I traveled as a young person. And even the world of ideas and places I would go through reading and research, right? So by that measure, I was quite different from Frank Streets. And I don't know, I guess like I didn't grow up. It's also probably what you grew up around. You mentioned my parents were educators. I didn't grow up around guns. So that question might be better posed to them. Why didn't you have a gun? To my father, I don't know. My mom's father, my grandfather, was a hunter, but he would own one gun and use it to go hunting. It was less of an identity factor mm-hmm. that I think that has kind of turned into in our culture in some ways. And I mean, the way you pose this idea of like people who feel safer with or without them, I mean, it'd be interesting to map on where they're from when they answer that question mm-hmm. or how they identify a region that they're from.
Yeah. Absolutely. Talking to Stephen J. West, whose book is called Soft Boiled, and he's got an event Thursday at 7 p.m. at Writers and Books, in person there, you pay what you want or what works for you. Free up to $20. It is technically a hybrid event, so you can, if you want to do the online, register and do that through wab.org. What do you plan to explore on Thursday night?
Well, I'm pretty excited about this event. It's the first reading I'll be doing in Rochester since the book was published in July. And I'm actually going to be in conversation with one of my friends who's also a fantastic writer, J.R. Fenn. She's a fiction writer and also an essayist. And so we just met, actually, to talk about what sections I might read to try to tailor the conversation to try to cover, because the book is pretty complex. I know we're talking a lot about masculinity today, but the book covers a lot, ideas about art making and process, memoir, self-investigation. And what we're going to try to do is select some passages that I will read that kind of give an overview of the many threads in this, that she will also kind of bring up questions and we can have a conversation. And I'm excited, too, to have some people there to allow into the conversation, too. So there'll be a Q&A section, too.
It's at 7 p.m. on Thursday night at Writers and Books. Again, in person if you'd like to go, or a hybrid event online, you can register at wab.org. And let's take our only break of the hour. When we come back with Stephen, we're going to talk about really what he saw with Frank a little bit. I'd like to talk about some of what you did see there. And, you know, he's right. He does wrestle a lot with masculinity. That's at the core here. We're going to talk about how he sees the term toxic masculinity in our second half hour. It may not be what you think. But we're also going to talk about the fact that Stephen's really hard on himself in a lot of other ways, too. I mean, you know, questions, you know, who should be creating art and writing art and, you know, who gets centered and, you know, his place as sort of a straight white writer, a male. So he's very open about some of that, and we're going to talk more about that with him in our second half hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, David K. Johnston joins us. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist is talking about the Donald Trump family and the possible investigations and prosecution of Donald Trump and his children. What should we know about what's happening in New York or on the federal level, and what does Johnston think we ought to be looking for next? We'll talk to him Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So let's tie up the Frank Street stuff because as interesting as he was, you did get to spend some time kind of following around with Frank. And you want to describe a little bit of what you saw? There were some very interesting things you saw in West Virginia with him.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, what I saw was probably what you picture a lot of West Virginia to be. Like, when it becomes the kind of target of our cultural, you know, stigma and stereotype, it's these, you know, empty back roads, dirt roads, ramshackle houses. You can picture the people there. And that's what we saw. And that's what those were the clients. Those were the subjects that we were investigating. What got kind of complicated was the way that this place is so intertwined and small. And so Frank Streets would be out investigating a certain, you know, a suspected adulterer on like a private case.
Yep.
And would say, oh, here comes a police car. I wonder if they're going to recognize me. And immediately my kind of radar goes up like, what? I thought we were just going to tail a suspected adulterer around and see where they go on their day off. And he's concerned about the police car that's coming the other way because he's also working another case where he's investigating a corrupt sheriff's department. And these places are small and they know him and he's been there a long time. So that was the part that really kind of turned it from a kind of pastiche or comedy, like here we are running around in a truck following a suspected adulterer. Like, isn't this silly compared to what people think of in terms of private investigators and the work they do? Like this kind of gritty urban detective. And I thought it would be funny, like not funny, but like an entertaining kind of counterpoint. Like, look at what a rural detective does. And then I realized that all that danger that makes those stories really interesting and compelling in cities, it's actually there and sometimes a little scarier in these small communities of intertwined kind of police departments and detectives and lawyers and corruption and all the cases that Frank Streets was working on around three counties in the area he lived.
Can't get away from it. Everybody knows everybody there.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, like this was one of the concerns I had about writing this book because, you know, I'm talking about real people and all of the cases that I summarize in the book really happened, are real people. You can look up all the facts and research. It's all information that I found through my own research and interviews. But it's something that's complicated for me to think about. Like, am I exploiting these people by writing about them? Is it really my story to tell? And these are questions that I wrestle with in the book, too, because I think they're valuable for someone who makes art, especially in the 21st century. So,
your constant invocation of that question eventually strikes a reader, I think, as wondering if you were just going to stop writing the book halfway through and say, nope, I can't do it. I'm the wrong person for this. I mean, at some point, I wanted to, like, just yell at you through the book. You can do this. Go ahead. Go right ahead. Just write this book. It's fine. I know that you're a white guy, but you can do this. But at the same point, I admire you for constantly asking and being aware of whose art has been consumed,
mm-hmm.
who gets published, who gets featured, who gets centered. So talk to me about wanting to be careful and thoughtful about that, even to the point of kind of pushing your readers, like, you're pushing us to really be aware of it, to make the point that you wanted to make.
Yeah, thanks for bringing this up, because I think it's actually an important project that I was invested in this book. As I'm, a writer, but I'm also a reader, and I pay close attention to contemporary writing and how much and how valuable the marginalized and diverse voices that are publishing now more than ever, and how often they use their identities as ways to pursue social justice. And I started to think about myself as an ally, as a white, cissexual, heterosexual male, and I'm like, well, how can I use my identity to show that allyship and actually pursue these same kind of ideas, this importance of inclusion? Didn't have to look too far to see that my own white, straight masculinity was something that not many people, like you're mentioning, don't write about or explore. And I thought I should do it. And if I was going to do it, I should do it without holding anything back.
Did you worry at all that you were sort of too self-flagellating on that?
Only after people started reading the book. And it's a very common response. My mom actually has to stop reading it because she felt so, like, I can't believe you're being too hard on yourself. That's something we said in the break, right? Like, it's kind of cringy to read. But for me, the project was important to do that. Because sometimes if you want to demonstrate what you believe is a model that the book is presenting, I think you need to go a little bit farther. It's kind of a persona that you can adopt. Now, is this in my entire personality? Do I sit around all day self-flagellating, like you're saying? No. But that's a part of me, just like it's a part of anyone who can be self-critical.
Sure. I think that awareness is important. Awareness of all of those themes that you raised there. And I'm also glad that you're doing okay and that you're not sitting around all day. Because you get to wonder, like, boy, this guy, I hope he doesn't hate himself. I was a little worried about you, but that's good. So on the subject then of masculinity, you were asked in a separate interview. Let me grab this here. An interview with Under the Hood Talk, your interviewer discussed that term, and you said, what do we even know about what that means? It's thrown around, toxic masculinity, so often that I don't know if it's considered deeply. Tell me more about that, and how do you see that term, that phrase?
Well, I mean, just the fact that it's become a kind of like ear candy, like you know that phrase, right? You almost hear toxic masculinity more than you hear either word on its own anymore. And I think it does tend to kind of capture and represent, or is used to try to capture and represent, a set of behaviors. Am I an expert? No. Am I the spokesperson for all men? Absolutely not. But what I do think about toxic masculinity, if it is existing as a phrase and has become this kind of term, then it probably represents a real problem. So do I know what the problem is per se? No. From my own experience, I can think about how to address it. If I see behaviors in myself that are maybe bred from privilege, from a history of a position of power, I start to question that. And I think that questioning is actually a good thing. And sometimes it comes across as being too self-punishing. But that was something, again, I was trying to demonstrate in the book. And I think listening more and asking questions are good habits for men to maybe combat whatever this toxic masculinity is.
So here's a question you probably, I don't know if you won't like it, but you don't consider Frank Streets to be an example of toxic masculinity?
Why? Because he owns guns?
Well, because it's sort of the ostentatious display.
Okay.
Thereof.
Well, I never saw him once inflict violence on someone. I could see him be judgmental. But I didn't see any violent act or hurtful act by intention. And I think that, I mean, I don't know if I'm just thinking of what toxicity would be. That would be a measure of it.
Okay. I think there's two sides of the Frank Streets coin. I think there is the importance of not just condemning someone who lives differently than us.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with that all the time. I don't want a world where everybody is the same. I don't want a world where everybody lives and has exactly the same values. But I think there have to be sort of boundaries and lines that we draw. So what I think has happened in the age of social media is the notion of acceptable boundaries has gotten narrower. And more of us think that whatever way you are living is, well, that's the right way. and someone else is stepping out. The other side of that is if we go so broad that it allows for any behavior to be sort of normalized or tolerated, including violence, but also discrimination, you know, and all of the problems that, you write about in different ways in Soft Boiled. So with someone like Frank, it's like, I think there's a real affection that you have for him, an appreciation for him, not only just for letting you in and letting you see his work and experience what you experience, but also the fact that you're so different, obviously different than him, but you could spend time with him, that there was a sense of that meshing of worlds. And so that strikes me as that says we're closer to alike than we are, than a lot of people realize, even if the way we live is different. But there's going to be people who say, well, you got to call them out more. Like the gun culture is XYZ, and how come you're not harder on that? What would you say to that?
Well, again, I think that's not necessarily what the project of this book was. I did not go in with an agenda of what I thought I would find and then say, oh, look, I found exactly what I thought I would find. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is about process and practice. And this is where in the book I investigate some of the commonalities between my practice as a writer and a researcher in the field and what Frank Streets describes as the integrity of being a private eye in search of facts and information to present to a client. Right. So I like that this book resists an easy kind of solution or conclusion about certain behaviors of all of the characters in this book, including myself. I think that that was important for me to lay out evidence. Right. I give my takes here and there, little leading questions, but I'm trying not to say here, book is closed on this matter. This person owns guns, therefore this.
Yeah.
This person acts this way, therefore this. I think that that reductive kind of quality relates to what you're talking about on social media. And I'm trying to resist that kind of reductive quality, both in how I evaluate Frank Streets as a man, if you want to talk about that, but also in my own behaviors as a writer, as a man, seeking these kind of traditional measures of success. I'm trying to make more complexity rather than be reductive. And I think that that's, I don't know, in some ways, what I was trying to model through the work.
I think that's very much evident in your work and your process. And we're in a world where call-out culture is all the rage right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that word rage on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I admire the intent that you have. It is the opposite of what we see in a lot of different quarters. I just don't know how much currency it has because everybody seems to want the opposite. Is that hard as an artist, knowing that the world is pushing in a different direction and you're trying to kind of see a little bit more openly and more generously?
It would be hard if I was really in it for the money. I'll put it that way. But
you could really become a real starving artist that way.
Right. I mean, there's a reason I published my book with a small press, because they would give me the kind of freedom to write the kind of art that I wanted without trying to make it fit into certain categories of what's consumable. And that was a real benefit to me. Sure, it means less sales, but I never got into this art thing for the money. And so in that, I don't know, it doesn't feel like it pushes me back as a writer. It actually inspires me as an artist to think about how I can create work that's more subversive or challenges certain cultural norms. And that's something I was trying to do with this book too.
Where does your own personal generosity end, whether it's with someone like Frank or anybody else in your life?
Well, like when someone cuts me off on the highway like that. I get a little heated there, but that's a good question. I don't know. I think when people are unwilling to listen, it's hard for me, or be open to listening, right? Opening to someone else's perspective. And I know I have this same flaw sometimes too, because I'll hear certain things in conversation or on the news or in social media that I'm like, how can I possibly empathize with this person or this perspective? So I know that I have that same propensity to kind of cut down, not be generous and willing to hear or meet someone where they're coming from. That's probably where. But I am aware of it, and I'm trying to push myself often to be more open and listen more.
Talking to Stephen J. West, whose book is Soft Boiled. You called a memoir. What's the category of this book? It's a lot of different.
Well, booksellers want to call it memoir because, like, that's what sells, right? It's like a story of my life at a certain time. But I'm it's probably esoteric, but I'm a little bit more of like a form nerd. So I call it a book-length essay And it's definitely hybrid because it has scholarship in it, critical discussions of gender theory. It does have that memoiristic thread of my life in West Virginia immediately after graduate school. But then it also has some conversations about detective fiction and kind of different stories that help me make sense of all these different moving parts that kind of came about while following Frank Streets.
When you think about masculinity, it's not just, it's not just your own worlder. I mean, you're a father. So what do you say? I don't want to peel back too deeply or push you to divulge too much here. But, you know, I mean, I've got a 10-year-old son. We talk about some of these concepts, and it's been very interesting for me to watch the way the forces of the world impact his view on things and trying to suss out nature and nurture, internal versus external. And I don't know that there will ever be a snug way to do that, but I try to be conscious of it and try to talk very generously about, you know, all of humans' capacity to be beyond just narrow definitions. How do you think we should talk to our sons about that, about masculinity?
It's a good question. It's a hard one too. And actually, it's my son's 11th birthday today, so it's a perfect question for it. I think that, well, what I've been doing with my spouse for these first 11 years has been thinking about what we expose him to and how we have conversations about what he sees. So far, I've had a lot of control over what he's exposed to, but now he's starting to investigate the world on his own.
Absolutely, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
He's got an iPad from his school, just gave him a laptop, which, you know, we're super privileged to be able to have that. But, you know, all of a sudden, the world of the internet is open. I'm hoping that what we've presented him in terms of the things, the books that we've read, the stories that we've shared with him, the places we've traveled, the conversations we've had about who we see, what we see when we're there. I'm hoping that this is a way for him to not just make sense of himself as a young man in the world, but also the world that he's a part of, independent of his masculinity. I think learning about the world first and all the people is important first. And that's, he starts with reading. Of course, I'm going to say that. We go to museums a lot too. Just try to invite more and more stories and perspectives without trying to like situate them, like, see, this is the right, this is the wrong. We don't do that conversation yet. I think that just kind of gathering all that info, gathering all that exposure, I think that that's a good in itself.
Do you like him at age 11? Because parents always love their kids, but you don't always like them.
It seems like a leading question. I do actually. I'm stunned by how smart he is and how dumb I am now. Suddenly, so yeah,
it's really a real treat to like your kids, not just love them to admire them. What would make you proud when he reaches adulthood? What would make you proud?
I'm pausing heavily there because that's I want to resist an answer to that. If he's making choices with others in mind, that would be something I'm proud of. Because, you know, he's coming from a world of great privilege. He's going to be educated. We have a lot we offer him. So, you know, the world is changing in a lot of ways, but it's still going to be his, so to speak. And I hope that he's always conscious of others and what he has in relation to them.
I think it's a great answer. Similar to how I mean, number one, I just hope my son is a kind person.
That's a good answer too. That was shorter, but
well, no, but yours is a little more complex than mine. No, kind for sure. Yeah, and then generally trying to discern how he might use his own gifts to make the world a better place. And that is a little bit squishy, but I don't mind that it's squishy because that's how I feel about it. And I own that. That's squishy. It's like, so what? That's what I want. And I think that he'll be happy if he's doing that. I think when we are not grateful and we are not sort of self-aware, we think we're happy because we are constantly pursuing something different and reaching as opposed to finding gratitude. So there's my squishy part.
That was a good answer. One thing you might want to consider when you say making the world a better place, you're going to have to be able to acknowledge and define what isn't necessarily good in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. Or just the fact that a lot of different people have a lot of different views on what better means. And that's okay too. But so let me further define that. I would hope he becomes an adult who is considering his own definition of how to make the world better and then pursues a life that goes in that direction. It doesn't have to be how I think the world should be better or how, you know, the media or anybody else. Mm-hmm. But I want him to think critically about the world, decide how he can try to make it better, and then be active in that in his life. Not every minute of every day, but just in a way that says he's self-aware.
It sounds like the process a writer goes through. It's pretty good.
Yeah, see? Well, look, you know, you've got us thinking about this with Softball. And that does lead me, as we've got a few minutes left with Stephen J. West, whose book is Soft Boiled. It's a book-length essay.
Thank you.
It's not exactly a memoir. It's kind of a memoir. The bookseller says it's a memoir. Do you have in your own mind what you hope readers will take from this book?
Yeah, I think that what I want as a writer is for people to see that there's a value to being really honest, brutally honest, maybe painfully honest in art. I think that I want readers to see that if someone is willing to challenge themselves, that maybe there's space for them to do the same. And this actually relates to, maybe a good story to share here. In June, before the book came out, I actually sent a copy to Frank Streets and had him read it.
Were you nervous?
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you were.
For sure. Yeah. The fact that he agreed to meet with me meant that I was probably safe, although I wasn't sure.
Yeah, no, that's debatable for sure.
Yeah, so he read it, and I drove down to Barber County and met with him and spent 7 hours with him talking with him. I planned for three. I told him three, and he kept me there for 7 hours. And we sat outside, and his wife cooked us food. We had fried livers. I think they were trying to, there's a scene in the book where I'm kind of fidgety about eating food with him, and they were trying to gross me out, I think. But it was good. I you know, what would you say, manned up and ate the livers. And anyway, we talked for 7 hours, and he ended up opening up to me about stories from his past, his childhood, certain traumas that he experienced, certain episodes of violence. And at one point, he even said, "I don't know why I'm sharing this with you." And he shared with me stories that he had heard from his son who served in the military, certain situations that he experienced overseas. And he said, again, "I haven't even told this to my wife. We didn't talk much about the gender stuff. That was a place that we didn't go in our kind of book interview conversation. He wanted to talk a lot about the cases, what has happened since, things that he said were not true, that he kind of called me out on, because I am critical with him in the book. But what his willingness to kind of share those stories, even to his own surprise, tells me that those themes resonated with him, those themes about masculinity, and even my own openness with them in the book. So, you know, you mentioned earlier in our interview, our talk, you were worried I hate myself or this kind of like going too far into this realm of self-punishment. But to me, by doing that, it allows others to maybe do it a little bit themselves. And that was an incredible experience that I had with Frank that I cherish. That conversation I had with him.
And clearly it sounds like, even though he's going to call you out on where he thinks you misstepped in the book.
Yes, of course.
That he had some affection for it?
He wouldn't say that. He said, "I don't know what to think about it." That was about all I would get. But he did sign copies of it for me, so.
That says a lot. Mm-hmm. Do you think that friendship will continue?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I reached out, like I said, I reached out to him to see if he would join us today. And I was really hoping he would, because I would love for listeners to hear this person and meet him on his own terms, have him say his part. But he said, "I've already told you what I think about the book." And that was it. But he did say, "Be well." So I think that means it could be to be continued. So.
Got an event Thursday night coming up. If you missed it earlier this hour, Stephen J. West's book is called Soft Boiled. The event is at Writers and Books Thursday night at 7 p.m. It's an in-person event. If you'd like, there is a virtual component as well. WAB.org for more information. Our last 90 seconds on why people choose to write. According to a 1947 craft essay by George Orwell, four reasons. Historical impulse, political purpose, aesthetic enthusiasm, or sheer egoism. And you say you fall into the egoism category. So You don't think that there's political purpose or, I mean, it was all the fourth category?
Well, this is, I hope my students are listening because this is something I share with them in class. And why George Orwell shares that in this essay is because he says that his first impulse was aesthetic enthusiasm, like he liked writing poetry. But the quote that's important in that essay is that in a period like our own, he says it's nonsense to think that there are some topics that we can avoid in writing. So maybe if I'm saying that sheer egoism is my first impulse, in a period like our own in 2022, what would be some topics that are nonsense to think we can avoid? And for me, that's my place in the world as a white cishet man, my privilege, and the need to kind of explore that for readers.
Fair. I really appreciate you coming on the program and talking about it. And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I know any book is a process, but this one especially. So the book is called Soft Boiled. Where do you want people to get it, by the way?
It's locally at Book Culture in Pittsford. You can order it from Kelson Books online. And you can come to Writers and Books on Thursday and buy one, and I'll sign it.
Thursday at 7 p.m. The book is called Soft Boiled. Stephen J. West, thank you for making time for the program, and for listeners, we'll see you then. They'll meet you on Thursday night.
Thank you so much.
From the whole team at Connections, hope you've enjoyed this Monday afternoon. Rob Braden, Emery Stein, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson saying thank you for listening, and we are back with you tomorrow. I'm member-supported public radio.